This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're joined by John Ronson, author of Men Who Stare at Goats, for part two of our ongoing segments, Music to Get Tortured By.
John Ronson talks about psychological interrogation techniques developed by the military. Everything from staring goats dead to making people talk.
Some months back, we told you about a Palestinian American who was imprisoned and tortured in Israel and now is being tried on U.S. soil on the basis of those tortured confessions. Today, we'll give you the amazing update.
6.5 days of an entirely closed hearing in which Israeli, quote, torture agents were allowed to testify hidden from the American people.
And we'll talk with a lawyer from the Electronic Privacy Information Center about what the government has been trying to do behind your back.
U.S. government trying to grab the records of all of the times we have searched on the internet. Google alone stood up for our rights.
All that and more on today's Law and Disorder.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th. In Chicago, a Palestinian American is facing criminal charges that are based on statements that he gave while undergoing torture by the Israeli government. Today, we'll be speaking with Michael Deutsch, one of Mohamed Salah's lawyers in Chicago, where there's an extraordinary closed proceeding going on in which the, quote, torturers are here from Israel to try and justify what they did. Michael Deutsch, welcome to Law and Disorder.
I'm happy to be with you.
I understand that you've just finished the first part of the legal proceedings in your case. We think that it's one of the most significant torture cases that's gone on in the United States. We have an American citizen, Mohamed Salah, who was over in Israel. He was picked up by the Israeli military, tortured, forced to sign a confession in a language he didn't speak, Hebrew. Put in prison for 5 years, comes back to his wife and family and business in Chicago. He gets reindicted, and they want to use the torture statement in Israel against him again. You make a motion to suppress the statement. You argue the motion for the last week in court behind closed doors. The press is kept out. You're under a gag order, and now you're on Law and Disorder. Tell us, Michael, what's at stake here?
Well, what I've been through is probably unprecedented in American judicial history. We've been, for the last 6.5 days, in a closed proceeding where the press and public have been kept out, where interrogators from the Israeli secret police, the GSS, have been testifying about their methods to the extent we can get them to testify about it and what happened to Mohamed Salah. Not only is the proceeding closed, but a substantial part of it is even closed to the lawyers and the defendant. When the government goes in the back with the Israeli witnesses and their lawyers, government lawyers and Israeli lawyers, and have secret classified proceedings about documents and testimony, which they say is classified because the Israeli government has said it's classified. The U.S. automatically classifies it as well. So the methodology of their torture, the things they do, are all being kept secret from the public and even from the defendant in the case.
Michael, the purpose of this proceeding is to demonstrate that the confession that the government is trying to use is coerced by torture. Is that right?
Yeah, it's not only that. It's coerced and not given by free will, but also the methods that were used that are undisputed. Over 85 days in interrogation, 13 days without a lawyer, incommunicado totally from anyone, all kinds of psychological and physical threats, being tied to a small chair while hooded for long periods of time, while waiting to be interrogated, sleep deprivation, isolation, are all so abhorrent and antithetical to the U.S. system that we shouldn't be allowing statements obtained this way in any U.S. courtroom.
But what they're doing here is kind of laundering a torture statement, because they don't torture them in the United States. They send the Israelis tortured there, and now they want to use this statement from Israel. It's a version of rendition, which our listeners know about, isn't it?
It's a delayed rendition, absolutely. They're trying to get a statement in Israel, even under the what they call the Landau methods, which were condemned by the Israeli Supreme Court in 1999 and said that they were violated international law, constituted torture, and prohibited them. These statements were taken in 93 when it was sanctioned by the Israeli government to do these methods. And yet, the U.S. government is using evidence obtained through these methods and wanting to put it in a U.S. courtroom in a U.S. trial.
Michael, I have a question. When you're in the courtroom, it's a closed courtroom, and I guess you're allowed to cross-examine, I presume, people from the Israeli Defense Forces and others, or the
GSS,
but are you allowed to talk about what you find out to the press? Or?
No, absolutely not. In fact, they're supposed to release transcripts of the proceeding that I was in, heavily redacted. They're going to go through it so that at some point, some partial part of the proceeding will be released to the public and the press.
So what's being hidden from us is really the techniques that the Israelis use to interrogate people. Is that right?
Yeah, and in fact, those techniques are being hidden from us, too, the lawyer and the defendant, because whenever our examination goes towards the specific methods and techniques and documents, they then say it's classified, and they go into the back with the judge ex parte without the defense lawyers there and without the defendant there. Double secrecy. There's one secrecy generally about anything they testify to, and then when you get to their real stuff, they want to make it secret to us.
Wow, this is really, this is an amazing chapter in American legal history, I'll tell you that. Unbelievable.
The other thing that's quite offensive is that this person's already been convicted and imprisoned, and it's like double
in
jeopardy.
Israel.
They want to do it to him again.
Yeah, in Israel, yeah. And that the day he came home off the plane in 1997, there was an FBI informant that was following him for 7 years until they indicted him in 2004. Every day writing reports on him, and even the FBI said the guy's not believable. But after 2001, with the Israeli lobby and then getting close to the election in 2004, they brought this indictment. And the indictment says that Hamas is a racketeering enterprise.
Now, can you say the name of your client again, Michael?
Mohammed Salah. I also want to tell you two great things that also happened in this hearing, which was public. We had Jonathan Katab, who is one of the leading Palestinian human rights lawyers in the occupied territories, who's been doing this for 25 years as the executive director of El Haq, which is a Palestinian human rights organization, who's written extensively about these issues. He testified about all the methods that he knew based on his work as a lawyer and as a human rights activist, about all the methodology of breaking the will and how 95% of the cases in the military court are based on confessions, and how their basic strategy is to isolate you with sensory deprivation and sleep deprivation and all these other things.
For those of you just joining us, we're speaking with Michael Deutsch, attorney at the People's Law Office of Chicago and attorney for Mohammed Salah, a Palestinian-American who traveled to occupied territories and was arrested by the Israelis, held, convicted, and imprisoned for 5 years, tortured and forced to sign confessions under duress and under torture.
In Hebrew.
In Hebrew, in a language he didn't understand, and is now in the United States being tried on the basis of those torture-induced confessions. And I think it's important to note here, if you could talk for a second, Michael, about whether or not this is, because people might think, well, he committed a crime because the Israelis arrested him. I don't think there's any real sense of how common it is for Palestinian men to be arrested and tortured in the occupied territories.
Well, thousands are arrested, detained, administratively detained, or held under interrogation. They use a military court that receives evidence in secret. All the human rights groups, both Israeli groups, Palestinian groups, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, have studied what goes on and found like 85% of the people who are arrested are tortured, 95% of the people confess. And the question is, what is the crimes anyway? I mean, the crimes are some part of resisting the occupation, which seems to me to be something that people have the inherent right and human right to do. Mohamed Salah was essentially arrested for giving out money to people in the occupied territories for humanitarian reasons after 400 people were deported to Lebanon in 1992. He was asked to come and help the families of the people who were deported. And that got him arrested and under this incredible interrogation that went on over 85 days. The other witness that came, listened to Jonathan Kitab, was a guy by the name of Yuval Ginbar, who was the main researcher and writer for an organization called B'Tselem, which is the main human rights organization in Israel. And on cross-examination, the government said, well, I shouldn't really ask you this question because I don't know the answer, but why have you come? In addition, of course, of saying he wanted to support Mohamed Salah, he said, I'm very disturbed that a United States court and the United States government, to which we've looked through in all our human rights work, is now going to take evidence produced under the Israeli system, which had systematic torture, and was going to allow that evidence to be used in a U.S. courtroom. And I'm very troubled by that, and that's why I've come all the way here to testify.
Michael, what can listeners do to help if they're concerned about this?
Well, they can write to the U.S. Attorney, Patrick Fitzgerald, a name people probably know, and demand that he drop the charges against Mr. Salah and end his, you know, nightmare. They could also, if they're in the Chicago area, come to court. We resume again next month with one of the leading Palestinian psychiatrists from Gaza, who's going to talk about how these procedures and methods break people's will. And also another human rights lawyer, Avigdor Feldman, who was Mr. Salah's lawyer for some period when he was being interrogated.
Yes, we're familiar with him. We also understand that Al McCoy, the history professor at Wisconsin who wrote the great book, A Question of Torture, has volunteered and would like to testify if the judge will permit him.
Yes, so far the judge has not been willing to let Professor McCoy testify. But it's actually what he's saying is really the whole superstructure, foundation of what the Israelis do. It's basically based on isolation, keeping people incommunicado, threatening them, and then breaking their will through sleep deprivation. And that's, the Israelis are the masters of it. You know, they don't put scars on you. They don't pull your fingernails out. They just break you through this process of isolation and psychological maneuvering.
This case is probably, as Michael Smith said, one of the most important cases going on in the country right now in terms of torture in the United States as well as the Palestinian issue. And there's been no press about it. There's been press in Chicago, which, because I look at it and look for it, but you even talk to people who are activists, Palestinian activists. Very few people are actually aware of it because of the total clampdown on the press. That's one amazing thing to me. And the other one, of course, is that both the techniques that the Israelis used are very similar to the techniques that are being used around the world now by the United States.
Absolutely.
From Guantanamo to Bagram, and that we even allow evidence from torture to come in to trials, so-called trials, that are going on in Guantanamo. So we have a real, your case is really the domestic side of what the U.S. is now doing internationally. It's remarkable.
It's a stalking horse for that principle to say, well, you know, the Israelis are fighting terrorism, so they need special procedures and they need to keep people isolated, and therefore if they get evidence that way, well, we should honor that evidence. And that's what the U.S. is going to be saying, right?
No, that's exactly right.
That's exactly right. They're taking us back to the days before the Fifth Amendment. They're taking us back to medieval Europe when people were routinely tortured. And it was the American Revolution and our Constitution and the Bill of Rights that got rid of that. And these people are bringing it back.
Pre-Enlightenment, the combination of torture and religion.
Michael Deutsch, the attorney for Mohammed Salah, People's Law Office in Chicago. Thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. We're going to be checking in with you regularly. We welcome you back to the program. We offer you our support and solidarity. Keep up the good work.
Thank you very much.
Before Guantanamo Bay, Cuba became notorious for its human rights violations against Muslims, it was the holding center for thousands of HIV-positive Haitian refugees. More than 10 years ago, a team of Yale law students and activists took up this cause. They worked to stop the U.S. government from detaining these refugees indefinitely at Guantanamo, without charges or access to counsel. Lawyer Brant Goldstein is author of Storming the Court, a look inside the controversy surrounding this story of the U.S. Supreme Court and Haitians who were discharged from Guantanamo Bay. Welcome, Brant, to Law and Disorder.
It's a great pleasure to be here.
Brant, your last name, Goldstein, reminds me of the great book about what you're going to tell us about 1984. And you sure had a 1984 experience with the U.S. government, didn't you?
It was actually my classmates. I was a third-year law student at Yale when my classmates filed suit against the U.S. government on behalf of a group of innocent Haitian political refugees held on, of all places, Guantanamo Bay.
Yeah, well, it's a famous case. We all know about it because our co-host, Michael Ratner, was closely involved in, and I understand is a character in the book. But please tell us what was at stake here and what they did.
And also, Brant, tell us how the students first got involved in this case.
Absolutely. To set the historical stage, President Jean-Bertrand Aristide of Haiti was ousted in a brutal military coup in September 1991. And after his ouster, thousands of Haitian democracy activists took to the sea, seeking asylum, safe haven in the United States. The U.S. Coast Guard brought them all to a place we know now very well, Guantanamo Bay. And they were interviewed there to determine whether or not they deserve political asylum in our country. We sent back about 25,000 to Haiti. We allowed 10,000 more into this country. And for 300 others who proved they deserved asylum here but tested positive, unfortunately, for HIV, we left them on Guantanamo, surrounded by razor wire and guard towers, that is, the U.S. government did, in what amounts to America's first HIV detention camp.
And why was that? Because was there a law that said HIV-positive individuals could not enter the United States?
Well, that's exactly right, Heidi. There's a federal regulation that was initially put on the books at the behest of Senator Helms at the time. And the idea was that people who are HIV-positive would be barred from entering this country. But we rarely enforce that regulation. The point is that we don't test people who are coming into the country. But we did focus on this group of innocent Haitian democracy activists. And of course, one has to ask the question, well, why them? Well, they're poor black Creole-speaking people from Haiti. I think for the law students who first got involved in this case, that was definitely an issue.
Considering that Helms sponsored the, Helms' father owned one of the biggest plantations in North Carolina.
Right.
How long were they detained at Guantanamo?
They were held there for over a year, some of them as long as from November 91 through June of 93. Of course, it obviously paved the way for or set a precedent for what is happening today.
But the story had a good ending for these 300 individuals.
Yeah, well, it was a remarkable tale with a lot of twists and turns, but it begins by having a group of students who at Yale were watching what's going on in the newspaper because this was it was a big story in the New York Times and so forth. And they approached an international law professor, a young man at the time named Harold Koh, K-O-H, himself the son of political refugees from South Korea, and persuaded him to join them in fighting for these Haitians' release. Clinton was then governor of Arkansas. This is fall of 1992, after 6 months of having sued the Bush administration. And Clinton on the campaign trail indicated that he would release the Haitians were he to be elected president. Unfortunately, after winning the White House, he went back on his word. And he left this group to languish there. And it's all the more ironic because, of course, he too was a Yale Law School graduate. And some of the people on the case, you know, when I interviewed them, would just roll their eyes and say, had he been a student, he would have been fighting alongside of us. Right. So what happened is they sued Clinton as well, and the case ended up at trial before a Bush appointee here in New York, in Brooklyn.
Sterling Johnson.
Judge Sterling Johnson, who had only been on the bench a few months and was a former narcotics prosecutor in New York and a former Marine who had served on Guantanamo. And he issued an order, ultimately, after his verdict on conclusion was that the Due Process Clause of the Constitution applies on Guantanamo because it is basically under our control, under our complete jurisdiction and control, and the Haitians cannot be held there indefinitely without charge. And so they were indeed released.
Were they placed in homes? Did they receive assistance in locating?
Yes. What the students did is they had worked very hard, and one of the people who led the effort is, he's now a law professor at NYU. His name is Michael Wishney, who's also involved in the Guantanamo litigation today. A very able student who, with many other students, led the effort to find ways to resettle the Haitians, not at taxpayer expense here. And so some were resettled with their families, others through private charities. And they were resettled in Brooklyn, in Queens, and in Miami.
This is a remarkable story of what law students can accomplish when they work together like this with a professor. We need more of this action.
We need more law students like this and less like Alito.
So storming the court basically tells the story of how this came about, the lawsuit.
This book is a narrative nonfiction account in the spirit of a civil action or In Cold Blood. I spent 6.5 years on this book, interviewed over 225 people, and I focus on just a few of the law students and Harold Coe, the law professor, and this extraordinary refugee, Yvonne Pascal, who spent 5 years telling me her story. She, in particular, is I tell this story, the Haitian experience, through her eyes. My goal is to get the reader to empathize with someone who we might consider, as Harold Coe described it before going to the Supreme Court, the ultimate other in this country, somebody who is poor from a developing country, who is black, who speaks Creole, and is not the kind of person that the INS, bluntly speaking, has been very kind to. And the amazing thing is she is now in this country thanks to these students. She works a full-time job, pays for her own health care, is a homeowner, and her older son is serving in the United States Marines and just came back from Iraq. And whether or not you agree with the war there, which I, for one, do not, if that's not a contribution to this country, I don't know
what
is.
The ultimate contribution.
Well, let's hope he's organizing anti-war GIs over there. Grant, let me ask you this. This would seem to have set a precedent with respect to stashing people in a hole in Guantanamo, but in fact, that's what they're doing now. So what happened, and why hasn't this been able to use as a precedent to get those innocent people who are languishing in Guantanamo as we speak out of there?
That's a great question. And the point is this. The Clinton administration agreed to comply with the order to release Yvonne Pascal and the other 300 innocent men, women, and children. But the Clinton administration was not comfortable with the precedent that the Constitution applies on Guantanamo. And so the Justice Department forced the Yale team representing the Haitians to make a deal. The Justice Department agreed they would not appeal the case. They would release the Haitians. But the Yale team had to agree that the lower court decision would be vacated, which is a fancy word for meaning erased, removed from the books. So what happens is, and for people who are not lawyers, this can be done as long as the case has not been finally decided by the Supreme Court. The decision, so to speak, belongs to the parties and not the public until the case is over. So as part of the settlement, it was wiped off the books.
So this is Clinton's Justice Department that did that?
It was Clinton's Justice Department that did this. And here's the great irony then. You flash forward 8 years later, the Bush administration lawyers who drafted the memo that said habeas corpus will not be available on Guantanamo from our reading of the past cases based their conclusion in part on reading the Haitian case and saying the Clinton Justice Department had it vacated. We don't have anything to worry about.
So what's the moral here?
When you fight for a precedent like this, And Harold Coe will tell you they were very concerned about giving it up. But their first and foremost obligation was to the 300 innocent men, women, and children that they were trying to save. And they realized, we've got to get them out of there. We have to bring them to this country and worry about them first. Yeah. And if the cost of this is that the precedent goes, perhaps that's what's going to happen.
You fight and you win a case in the courts. It's like a shell game, you know, then the legislature takes it away from you, or the executive takes it away from you, and we really don't have anybody that represents us. And so these things happen to us continually.
Of course, one could say, well, they could have fought on appeal. They felt that they would lose the case if it went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the reason they felt this was that the Supreme Court had intervened early on in the case in favor of the government. The students had won right out of the box a decision that they should have access to Guantanamo to meet with their clients, which is, of course, a big issue today.
We have in the studio with us Brant Goldstein, whose book, Storming the Courts, is hot off the press. Storming the Courts by Brant Goldstein. He was a student at Yale Law School, now was a lawyer for a while, now is a journalist, and he's written this extremely interesting story about how you fight the government and win.
Brant, you mentioned one student who'd worked on the case is now a law professor.
Yes.
What are the other students doing?
A number of different things. I think the case was a transformative experience for some of them. Michael Wishney, the one I mentioned, the law professor, had been involved in community work before and in work helping New Haven's homeless, but he'd always had doubts about sort of the big picture impact litigation, and he saw what a case like this could do, and it helped set his course, and he's now a professor specializing in immigration law at NYU. Lisa Dugard, who was also one of the student leaders and a big divestment activist before she came to Yale. She graduated from college when she was 16 and had a PhD at Cornell before she even got to Yale.
Incredible. That's even better than what you did, Heidi.
She was a born activist. She tied herself and her sister to the tree trunks of their backyard when they were 2 and 4 years old, respectively, to protest her father from cutting them down.
Wow.
She is now a public defender in Seattle. And Tori Clausen, the other student I focus on, works for Save the Children in Nepal.
Did you have a chance to talk with our own Michael Ratner on this case?
Michael Ratner was a key figure in this litigation. He was sort of, we joked around, the Obi-Wan Kenobi, the senior, the mentor who had been through some of these tough fights with the government before. And I interviewed him many times for this book, and he appears throughout the text. And in fact, now the big question is who's going to play him in the movie, because Warner Brothers has purchased the film rights.
And, congratulations.
Storming the Court is hopefully going to come to the silver screen sometime in the next
year.
That's
Do you have a
fabulous.
Suggestion who should play Michael Ratner, Heidi?
I wanted to know, Brant, aside from the movie, which is so exciting, what
too
do you have
Marlon
next
Brando's
on your...
so overweight.
Marlon Brando's dead, Michael.
Well, that's another reason we can't use him.
What's next on your plate? Any books lined up?
Yeah, I've been writing pieces for Slate and the Washington Post, and I'm now covering legal academia for the online edition of the Wall Street Journal. But getting ready to start working on another book soon. And I joke that I'd like it to be about Hawaii and that it should require a lot of research.
Well, I hope that you'll tune in to Law and Disorder, Brant, because we have all kinds of stories every Monday, 10 o'clock, just like the kind that you told. Tell us about that book.
Brant Goldstein, author of Storming the Court, the real-life story of a battle that Yale law students took on and were victorious in.
Thank you, Brant.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Your heart, 'cause I know you're
For a long time, there has been a concern about the government reaching into our computers and our private homes and businesses and finding out from internet companies and service providers what we've been searching for and what we've been researching on our private computers.
Sherwin Tsai works as staff counsel through EPIC's Internet Public Interest Opportunities Program. His work includes the impact of communications law and policy on privacy, as well as the privacy implications of commercial data gathering. Welcome, Sherwin, to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you.
Not a lot of press has gotten out about the Google settlement. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, sure. What's going on is the Department of Justice is actually a civil defendant in a case, and as part of putting together their defense, they wanted to conduct some statistical research. So they demanded a list of websites indexed by Google, as well as a list of search terms that people had submitted to Google. They did this with various search engines, and of all of them, Google was the only one that publicly said, no, we're not going to comply with that, and they actually went to court over it.
They asked Google, give us your top 1,000 searches. Is that the kind of information they asked for?
Originally what they asked for was, give us 1,000,000 websites that you have indexed, and also give us everything that anybody had searched for over the course of 2 months.
So they were asking this of all the internet search engines.
They asked of at least 4 major search engines. I think MSN, Yahoo, Google, and I'm blanking on the last one.
Let me go back. You mean if I put in a term like I want to look for the, you know, George Washington or something on the, and I put that in as a search term, that would be one of the ones that would have to be turned over?
Not if you did that now. What they were looking for originally, and this has been scaled back significantly.
No, but originally that's what they were looking for, was everything.
Well, originally they were looking for everything that was searched for, I think, in June of 2004 to July of 2004.
Right.
Sure, wouldn't that be a voluminous amount of information with all the people that Google every day?
It would have been absolutely massive, and that's one of the major obstacles that Google mentioned in opposing it at first.
But everybody else just handed it over.
Well, we're not entirely positive as to the contours of the request, of the Justice Department's request to each search engine, but it does seem like the other engines did comply.
Would there be any way to trace those to the people who made the request?
There would be, not from the information handed to the government. If that's all that was, if all that the government gets is what they asked for, then no. On the other hand, if you do find those search terms in there and you want to find that out, you can subpoena Google again. They would be able to correlate that with IP addresses, or they'd be able to correlate it with cookies that the Google search engine places on your computer.
Well, let's go right to the heart of this for us guys as civil liberties people. If we're planning a demonstration on some corner and we're searching information about that or communicating with people about that or searching different ways of protesting, they would get that and be able to find out about it, I presume.
Well, they're saying that the protective order in this case would prevent uses like that. What I'm saying is it's technically possible for them to do that. The information they have now probably wouldn't give them the ability to do that.
Unless they came back and then asked for the second tier of information.
Yes, which would be in violation of the protective order.
Mm-hmm. I know Google has its own Gmail email service that people, that has no connection to this particular.
Well, to this particular instance, no, but I think it's important to notice that the cookies that Google puts on your computer can be correlated and can be matched across different services. So if somebody wanted to find out what I'd searched for, if somebody gets that information, traces it back to the Google cookie, and they can also trace that back to my identity, my Gmail account.
Mm.
So that's certainly technically possible, and that's one of the things we worry about with Google is just the quantity and the types of information that they store.
Is it a settlement?
What's been going on is that the Justice Department and Google have been going back and forth in correspondence and apparently at oral argument as well in court, and they've been negotiating. And the Justice Department has now said they're going to ask for only 50,000 websites and for 5,000 search terms to be picked at random from some time in the past. That makes the actual information that the Justice Department is getting from Google less of an immediate privacy concern. However, I think it shows even more the importance that this precedent not be set.
Mm.
It shows that the Justice Department, they already have information from the other search engines. What they want out of Google is less the actual data right now and more the confirmation that they're able to do this.
And compliance.
That's right.
Yeah, so that's really a dangerous thing because, I mean, they could go after everybody who's checked, you know, the word Palestine, for example, in this country and then trace it back if they get the right to do this.
Or impeachment.
And I think it's funny because we're not even talking about a criminal investigation in this case. We're talking about a civil suit in which the government is a defendant. So the breadth of the precedent that might be set, I think, is very, it could be troubling. Anybody who's involved in a litigation, would that give them the ability and the authority to file a subpoena, to send a subpoena to a search engine and ask for their opponent's search records?
Well, Sherwin, what do you think the responsibility of these private corporations is to their users? Millions of people, you know, use them every day. So, for example, in China, MSN, on their search engine, they block words like democracy, freedom, human rights. And so if these same companies are willing to do this to individuals in other countries, what kind of implications does this have for our rights here?
Well, I think that's something very important to think about, especially because, as you say, definitions of legitimate law enforcement uses vary widely, not just from country to country, but from agency to agency and community to community. Yeah, I think these companies do have a responsibility to not just roll over to every single request that they receive. They have a responsibility to evaluate what they're presented with and make sure that it is not just within the letter, but the spirit of the law.
Are there sample guidelines?
Well, there are guidelines, certainly for data handling. I mean, the OECD has a set of guidelines and principles for handling data and preserving privacy in those. The ideas are pretty simple, and they're fair information practices that have been encoded into various parts of U.S. law as well, but nothing that applies directly to the private sector. These are ideas like data minimization. You only collect what you need to get the job done. Don't store things for longer than you need. And once you're done with it, delete it.
What kind of privacy expectation can we have when we are in our homes or our offices and doing research or anything on the Internet?
If you're talking about a Fourth Amendment expectation of privacy, there's only very specific and sort of compartmentalized protections for various types of information. Generally, when you give information over to a third party, you've relinquished your expectation of privacy in that information.
We've been at the Center for Constitutional Rights, have a lawsuit against the NSA on wiretapping and possibly email communications. Is that something that Epic works with at all, or is there something to this NSA stuff that they're able to get a hold of our emails?
As to the details of the NSA program, I don't think we've seen anything that most others haven't. I mean, most of our work has been through the Freedom of Information Act, and we've been posting what we've found on the website, but what they've been giving us is either heavily redacted or they're withholding it.
We know they have the ability to scan every email that goes through, but we don't know what they're doing at this point.
I certainly don't. Yeah.
Sherwin, we only have a few minutes left, but could you give our listeners information on Epic if they're interested, for example, in getting your newsletter?
Sure. You can go find EPIC's website at www.epic.org, that's .org. There's a series of resources available there. You can also subscribe to our newsletter, the EPIC Alert, which you can find links to on the site itself.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on Law and Disorder, Sherwin. We look forward to hearing more on the outcome of this lawsuit.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Weeks ago, we talked about the types of music used as an implement of torture by the U.S. government. You can listen to that segment on lawanddisorder.org. These techniques involve subjecting prisoners to 24 hours, 36 hours, in some cases, of music by artists such as Metallica, Eminem, or Michael Jackson. So it may not sound like torture to some, but this non-lethal torture technique permanently damages the minds of prisoners. In our second part of this Music to Get Tortured By series, we're joined by author and filmmaker John Ronson. John is the creator of a number of books and films, but among them is the book Men Who Stare at Goats. which uniquely explores exotic and horrific interrogation techniques by the U.S. military. John Ronson, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hello, and thank you very much for having me. I'm very glad to be here.
Well, you know, I have to say, we're really thrilled to have you here. We're doing a four-part series called Music to be Tortured By. Initially, when our producer gave us your book, The Men Who Stare at Goats, we thought this was just going to be about music and people being tortured by music, but it's actually much more, and it's first, I thought it was just kind of quirky, and then I started to get really disturbed, I think somewhere around the middle of the book, straight through the end, about some of the things that are going on with military psychological operations. Tell us a little bit about the book.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're right. It starts as a funny tipping point kind of book, and suddenly about halfway through it kind of lurches into something a lot more vicious, which is very much, I think, how it happened in real life. It's the story of how the U.S. military, in the wake of Vietnam, turned to the emerging human potential New Age ideas of California in the late 70s to come up with inspiration to fight future wars in a more ethical way. They sent various colonels out into California to mix with New Age gurus and so on, and how they came back with these wonderful new ideas, and these ideas then got twisted and mutated and perverted over the years into brutal new interrogation techniques and so on. So it starts off as a story, a kind of madcap story of special forces sergeants trying to kill goats just by staring at them and walk through their walls and so on.
But they were able to kill a goat, is that right?
Yeah, well, exactly. Well, they really did. They had a whole team of goats, of covert goats, at Special Forces Command Center at Fort Bragg in North Carolina. And these goats were all on base for conventional medical training purposes. You know, you could throw a hand grenade in and blow up a couple of goats, and then the Special Forces soldiers would rush in and try and nurse the goats back to health. This is kind of rational, understandable use of goats in a military training setting. But when these New Age ideas kind of infiltrated their way into Fort Bragg, into Special Forces, suddenly these goats were herded into rooms so soldiers could try and kill them just by staring at them.
How long did you have to stare at a goat to kill it?
Well, I'm not sure that any goats ever actually did die in this fashion.
It just collapsed.
Yeah, well, I think if any of them fell over, and a few of them are purported to have fallen over, I've got a feeling it's because they were in a shaky medical condition anyway.
You talked about, but in seriousness, you talked about the use of these New Age techniques gone awry and kind of evil, in my opinion, at places like Guantanamo and Iraq. Tell us about how these are being used today, or how you think some of these techniques are being used today.
Yeah, I mean, I came very much to the conclusion that at Guantanamo Bay and in some of the prison camps in Iraq, much like at David Koresh's Branch Davidian Church in Waco a decade earlier, these places were seen by the military as experimental interrogation labs where half-remembered ideas from think tanks of yore had an opportunity to flourish. When the Abu Ghraib torture photos came out, I think some people were asking the wrong questions. Everyone was asking, well, how high up does this go? And I thought maybe this is the wrong question. The question should be, how do these ideas form? And I think a whole bunch of middle-ranking people were half-remembering nutty think tank meetings they went to 15, 20 years earlier when people were coming up with ideas to blast people with subliminal sounds or, you know, blast them with high and low frequency sounds. And certainly from the Guantanamo detainees I spoke to, they said that, you know, they were constantly having Chris Christopherson and Fleetwood Mac blasted at them.
Tell us how you know, because I think the vast majority of the American public understands that the American military is blasting Barney or any kind of music or Metallica or whatever it may be in these containers that are holding Iraqis for 24 hours a day, and people are held under torturous conditions listening to this music at full volume. However, I don't think they understand what you reveal in this book, that there are oftentimes subliminal messages designed to evoke certain reactions. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, I've got to say, the thing about subliminal messages, we know that they tried it out at Waco. Yeah, they flew in a Russian scientist called Igor Smirnov, who recently died. And Smirnov was employed by the Soviets to blast subliminal messages at Red Army troops on their way to battle in Afghanistan. And the messages that would be blasted silently to the Red Army troops were things like, do not get drunk before battle.
My name is Smirnov is actually saying that. That's chutzpah.
Yeah, yeah. This sounds like really spooky conspiracy stuff. But, you know, I've been to the radio studios at Fort Bragg in North Carolina. All we're talking about is a soldier kind of whispering into a microphone, you know, surrender, confess. You know, it's not, in practice, it's not quite as spooky as it sounds. And so, yes, so Smirnov was doing that. So then they flew in Colonel John Alexander and a few other military intelligence guys, sort of esoteric specialists, flew Smirnov to Arlington when Koresh was holed up in the church, the idea being to subliminally, to silently blast the voice of God into the church, telling Koresh to surrender.
Charlton Heston agreed to play the voice of God. Is
yeah,
that right?
In the declassified documents of that meeting that you can
find.
What
an ego.
Charlton Heston had apparently already agreed to play the voice of God.
Now, how to take this forward to Guantanamo and Iraq and what you heard about what kind of music and what were the subliminal messages and whether the soldiers stayed in the room while it played, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, you suddenly see the music come alive again in Iraq and Cuba. And it dawned on me that every time the military, the U.S. military, has a bunch of people surrounded, all these kind of weird esoteric techniques come out. Because it's not that often when you think about it that the American military has people surrounded. And on every occasion, these people are treated like lab rats in the midst of a golden opportunity to try stuff out. And I interviewed a Guantanamo detainee called Jamal Al-Harris. Now, he said that music was being used in many different ways. Sometimes it would be blasted, you know, just a way to keep people awake, just sleep deprivation, this loud heavy metal music, Metallica and so on. Other times it was used as a way to screw people up culturally, so they would take, just like they were doing, we know about the prostitutes smearing menstrual blood, either real or fake menstrual blood on the faces of the devout as this kind of way to screw with them culturally, and we know that they were trying that with music as well. So we're talking sleep deprivation, and we're talking messing with people's minds culturally. Then you've got a third way, which is this thing that's known as the Buka effect. This is when you stick somebody in a shipping container in the Iraq-Syrian border in Al-Qaim, it happens, and you blast them for 24, 36 hours with loud music while flashing a strobe light at them. And in non-lethal weapon circles, this is known as the Buka effect.
And say that again, the what effect?
Buka, B-U-C-H-A.
Uh-huh.
And Commander Sid Hill of the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department explained to me what the Buka effect was all about. He's one of America's leading non-lethal weapon exponents. What he said to me was, imagine the situation that you're walking down a corridor at night, a figure jumps out in front of you, and you scream, and then you realize it's your wife. And your brain is working at two different speeds at that point. And if you can seize hold of that moment of debilitating shock and nausea before you rationally realize that the figure who's jumped out in front of you is your wife, that would be the ultimate non-lethal weapon. And the quest for that is called the quest for the Buka effect. And the idea about blasting Barney the Purple Dinosaur or whatever it is for 24, 36 hours while flashing the strobe light in this kind of grotesque disco is a quest for the Buka effect. By the way, the conspiracy theorist in me has always wondered why it was disseminated that they blasted people with Barney, the I Love You song, because it kind of sounds funny. And we know, you know, anybody can look up the internet and see what everybody was saying when we discovered that Barney was being used to torture prisoners in Iraq. It kind of turned torture funny.
People don't want their teenagers to go to a Metallica concert, but nobody has a problem with Barney.
It's like cozy torture.
Yeah.
Torture's not that
It's like
bad.
It's not really harmful, but it's creating harm without leaving marks.
So what's the reason for Barney?
Kenneth Roth of Human Rights Watch. I was glad he shared this theory because it made me feel less of a conspiracy nut. Because he's such a sensible guy. He said that the American military is very It's canny and it's cunning. And suddenly Barney torture becomes the funniest joke of the war, and torture doesn't seem that bad. And he certainly came to believe that PSYOPs, psychological operations, had deliberately disseminated the Barney story to make us all laugh at torture.
But what is, do they actually do the Barney music, and what, why would they do it? What's the purpose?
Well, and this story broke because a Newsweek journalist called Ivan Fiore was told by a PSYOP sergeant called Mark Hadsall to go out back. This was in Al-Kaim on the Syrian border, go out back where the prisoners are. And he saw with his own eyes this strobe light and, you know, some guy inside a shipping container, and the music's reverberating off. And when he asked for a playlist of songs, which is what Newsweek had asked him to find out, Barney came up as one of the songs. So that's how we know about Barney. I was sent some photographs of somebody who'd been given the Barney treatment, and as I say in my book, as I say in The Many Spherical Goats, you know, this young guy with a wispy moustache inside a shipping container is screaming so hard it looks as if he's laughing.
So you have those three sort of things, and then you have the fourth thing you mentioned in the book of when they leave the record, they...
This is the weirdest one,
right.
And it's the one that Jamal didn't really want to tell me because it just seemed so odd, and I felt quite weird about putting it in the book because it seemed so odd. But what they did was, in the interrogation block, they stuck Jamal in a room, played him a CD from beginning to end, Kris Kristofferson or Fleetwood Mac, and then when the CD finished, they came back into the room, put it on again, and left the room. This was normal volume. No blasting, no strobe light, just a CD playing over and over and over again.
In the interrogation room, yeah?
Yes. I said, what, were they trying to entertain you? And he said, no, believe me, I was in Guantanamo Bay for 2.5 years. They were not trying to entertain me. So I said to him, well, why were they doing this? And Jamal said, search me. The conclusion that we came to, and this was guesswork, there's a couple of times in The Many Spherical Goats when I am forced to kind of resort to guesswork, and the conclusion I came to was that they were trying out, you know, in this laboratory that was Guantanamo, they were embedding in these CDs high frequencies or low frequencies or subliminal messages or silent sounds. This thing that came alive in Waco was coming alive again in Guantanamo Bay.
You mentioned in your book that there are these subliminal sounds that are actually patented and they're real and they do evoke real emotions.
Yes, and they were patented by the U.S. military. You can watch the development of these things, like footprints in the snow, and then like in a horror movie, the footprints just stop.
What are some examples?
A Georgia scientist called Dr. Oliver Lowry, who patented this silent sound technology that was bought up by the U.S. military and vanished into the U.S. military.
But what are the messages they're trying to, like, we don't know them, obviously, because they're subliminal, but what kind of messages do we think they are trying to give the Guantanamo detainees?
I can't even guess. I just think that Guantanamo, it's an opportunity to try out all these schemes, however cockeyed and harebrained. And I should add, by the way, that if they are trying this stuff, there's no evidence that any of it actually works.
Right.
I said to Jamal, you know, if you feel as if you were being kind of influenced by these kind of weird psychological forces, and he said, nope.
Yeah, although I think the subliminal stuff we don't know about, but certainly blasting this music for a day and a half to these people, I think that's enough to drive you psychotic.
That works. There's no question about that. That works. Whether it will produce any decent evidence, though, is another matter. I mean, if you're driving somebody insane, you know, giving them a sense of absolute debilitation and nausea, are they going to get any decent information out of them?
We asked that question to Al McCoy, who wrote the book A Question of Torture.
Uh-huh.
And his answer to it was, well, it usually doesn't produce anything worthwhile. It gives the torturers an illusion of power. Hmm. I mean, that makes sense.
An illusion of power, absolutely. It's startling. I would say I contributed to Ira Glass's This American Life show on NPR, and he said in his show that nobody who worked in the This American Life offices had seen a Guantanamo detainee give an interview on mainstream American television or radio. That shocks me.
It's a very hidden story here. I mean, it's compared to the British press. You know, I represent a lot of the detainees, and there's no comparison. I mean, the British have it all the time. We have almost nothing about it. Next week, we're having a forum in Washington about, you know, with some of the testimony but by video. But essentially, none of them have done it. In fact, now that, you know, Mozambique has his new book out, they could be showing some of it. But other than Democracy Now!, we haven't seen it.
Really shocked me. When I first heard Iris say that, I thought, God, you've not been watching TV. But now I realize that, yes, it's just it's not there. It's
right.
Unseen. And the only reason I can see is that the owners of the mainstream American media are in the pockets of the administration.
Well, the New York Times helped the build up to the Iraq war as opposed to, say, the Guardian or the Independent. We got a different kind of press here.
But we really appreciate it. The book is great. It's called The Men Who Stare at Goats. And if you want to be shocked, amused for a short while, then floored at what our military has tried to do to human beings as well as goats, pick up a copy of The Men Who Stare at Goats. It's by John Ronson. Thank you, John, really, for being our guest today.
Thanks so much. I enjoyed it.
Thanks, John.
I took myself down to the tally hotel.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. Law and Disorder is produced by Jeff Brady. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.
And as I was searching from bottle to bottle for something unfoolish to say, that silver-tongued devil just slipped from the shadows and smiling stole her away. I said, hey, little girl, don't you know he's the devil? He's everything that I ain't. Hiding intentions of evil under the smile of the saint. All he's good for is getting in trouble and shifting his share of the blame. And some people swear he's my double, and some even say we're the same. But the silver-tongued devil's got nothing to lose. I'll only live till I die. We take our own chances, pay our own dues. The silver-tongued devil and I. Like all the fair maidens who laid down beside him, she knew in her heart that he'd lied. Nothing that I could have said could have saved her, no matter how hard that she tried. 'Cause she'll offer her charms to the darkness and danger of something she's never known, and open her arms at the smile of the stranger who love her, leave her alone. And you know, he's a devil, he's everything that I ain't. Hiding intention of evil under the smile of a saint. All he's good for is getting in trouble and shifting his share of the blame. And some people swear he's my double, and some even say we're the same. Silver-tongued devil's got nothing to lose. I'll only live till I die. We take our own chances, pay our own dues.
the silver-tongued devil, and I